It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, our guest explains why urban areas in Wisconsin are seeing population growth while rural areas are shrinking.
First, there's no voting this week, but there's still some big news on the presidential campaign trail. Paul Ryan shared some strong opinions on who should be considered as a nominee at a contested convention and who shouldn't. Candidate Donald Trump suggested some possible running mates if he wins, and there's been a big fight for delegates, one vote at a time.
Harry Enten joins us every week at this time to give us his take on the big stories from the campaign trail and beyond. Harry's senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Paul Ryan, as we mentioned, seemed tentatively to be ruling out the idea that he could be a nominee for the presidential race. Let's give a listen to what he had to say.
We have too much work to do in the House to allow this speculation to swirl or to have my motivations questioned. So let me be clear. I do not want, nor will I accept the nomination for our party. So let me speak directly to the delegates on this. If no candidate has a majority on the first ballot, I believe that you should only choose from a person who has actually participated in the primary. Count me out. I simply believe that if you want to be the nominee for our party, to be the president, you should actually run for it. I chose not to do this. Therefore, I should not be considered, period, end of story.
Harry, it sounds like he's really on the fence there, if I'm reading that right. No, I'm kidding. Is that really as definitive as it sounds?
Look, future President Ryan, no. I'm not sure what he's supposed to do here. You know, if he says he's not going to run, all of a sudden people say, oh, no, he's just lying. If he keeps quiet and says nothing, oh, he's being coy. I mean, let's take the man at his word. I mean, it does really sound like he doesn't want any part of this. Now, of course, he also claimed he didn't want to be speaker, and then look at what happened. But this is a very different ballgame. I mean, he was already in the arena when it came to the House of Representatives and being speaker. Here, as he's clearly said, he did not run for president. I mean, does this Sherman-esque type statement mean that he can't possibly be the nominee? No, but I think at the end of the day, when you look at what's going on, and we can get into it on the delegate math and the selection of the delegates at these state conventions, most of these people are either Trump people or, for the large part, even if they're Trump supporters on the first ballot, they may be Cruz people on the second, third, fourth ballot. So I don't really see a President Ryan in the future, a Republican nominee Ryan in the future. And clearly, it seems, at least, he doesn't want any part of it if we take him at his word.
And we take you at your word, Harry. And yet, Paul Ryan released a video that a lot of people say looks kind of presidential, like a campaign ad, if you will. Is he at least maybe not this year running, but maybe trying to set the table for 2020?
Sure. I mean, remember, he's only talking about this year, saying he's not going to run. Paul Ryan has often been talked about as a potential presidential candidate, or Republican nominee, going back a few years now. And if you look at the polls and you look at just generally where this Republican race is heading, their chance is greater than not that the Democratic nominee will probably be Hillary Clinton, will be the president of the United States. Now, that's far from guaranteed. But there is certainly some room to try and suggest that maybe, hey, down the road, think of me and I can be the savior of the party in 4 years.
Well, interestingly, the other name that had been thrown around at some points for that non-candidate emerging as the so-called white knight in a contested convention was Mitt Romney, who Ryan ran with a few years back. Ryan here saying, hey, delegates, only vote for someone who ran at some point in this campaign. So that, if they followed his guidance, would rule out somebody like Mitt Romney, too.
It absolutely would. I mean, I'm not, you know, privy to the insider talk between the two of them. I wish I were a fly on the wall when they were having a telephone conversation. Unfortunately, I'm a human being. But I would say that, you know, Mitt Romney has basically, even if he hasn't issued the same Sherman-esque type of statements, he's clearly said get behind Ted Cruz at this point. And remember, Romney is an older guy. Romney has very low favorables right now among Republican voters. He would not be the type of figure that I think Republican delegates would be able to coalesce around Republican voters and feel good about the process. So I think Romney recognizes that. I think Ryan recognizes that. It's probably going to be, you know, if it's not Donald Trump, it's probably going to be Ted Cruz, the Republican nominee. But we'll see what happens. I mean, you get to a contested convention, who knows? We haven't had one of these in so long that I don't think anyone really knows how it will all go down.
We're talking presidential politics right now with Harry Enten from 538.com. And Harry, let's dig into the delegate tallies before we go any further. How's it looking? Is it looking like this contested convention scenario is a distinct possibility at this point?
Oh, I think it's absolutely a possibility. In fact, our website just published some new sort of delegate tallies. And basically, you know, you need 1,237 delegates, a majority, in order to win. And right now, I think, and I'm very close with my colleague Nate Silver on this one, we have Trump probably getting actually only about 1,160 or there and about, which, of course, is well short of 1,237. Now, the question is, this only looks at the pledged delegates. There are 100 plus unpledged delegates. For instance, there are 54 in Pennsylvania that we can't possibly allocate because we don't exactly know how they're going to go. But Trump clearly is in some trouble. He is far from guaranteed of getting that 1,237 on the first ballot. And if he falls short, if it gets to a second ballot, based upon what we know of who the delegates are and who they may secretly support, even if they are pledged to Trump on the first ballot, it doesn't look good for him on a second ballot. So it is far from guaranteed that he wins the Republican nomination.
And now there's a battle, almost delegate by delegate in some places. The Cruz campaign trying to line up first ballot delegates, or, as you say, get those people who are Trumpers in the first round, can go anyway in the second and subsequent rounds. You wrote about what just happened in Colorado as an example of how the Cruz campaign appears to be way better at this job of getting these delegates than the Trump campaign.
Yeah, so Colorado held a convention, held a number of quote-unquote conventions, both on the congressional district and the statewide level. And basically, there were just a few voters who were determining who these delegates would be. And Cruz just out-hustled, out-organized Donald Trump and was able to get all 34 of the delegates at stake, which is a pretty big deal, you know, when we're going delegate by delegate by delegate. And beyond Colorado, if you look at these other contests, remember, there's a difference between delegate slots and delegates. The delegate slots are basically those, you know, Trump has delegate slots, that is people or slots that will have to vote for him on the first ballot. But the actual delegates are oftentimes not voted upon by actual voters. They are voted upon in a separate process in conventions. And these conventions tend to be considerably more friendly to Ted Cruz, and Ted Cruz has been cleaning up in them. So if we get to a second ballot, these people, as you said, these delegates may in fact be more favorable to Ted Cruz in a second ballot.
How ironclad are these delegate pledges, though? I mean, can't anything change once these delegates hit the convention floor?
Sure. I mean, you know, there are a whole bunch of ways that the rules can change, you know, crazy stuff that could happen with the Rules Committee. But if, you know, if we forget the crazy talk and the sort of West Wing scenarios, and we sort of look at who these delegates are, you know, on a second ballot, they are not pledged to Ted Cruz, but they do seem to be more favorable towards him. They are people that have been pushed by his campaign. So sure, maybe, possibly, Donald Trump could somehow entice them. For instance, he could tell them to, you know, give him a nice trip to Mar-a-Lago, which may be ethically wrong. I don't believe there's anything legally wrong with it. But if you really look at it, these types of people don't tend to be Trump supporters. Trump supporters tend to be those who maybe haven't been as involved with the party, while these Cruz people who seem to be winning these delegate slots seem to be significantly more conservative. And Donald Trump may be a lot of things, but I think most Republicans would argue that he's not really all that conservative.
Hey, another bit of news from the Republican side with the Wisconsin connection. Donald Trump, you're saying he's the front runner. He thinks he'll win this thing. Talking about possible running mates. Marco Rubio, who he once called Little Marco or a choke artist, Governor John Kasich, who he called a dummy in the past, worst presidential candidate in history, and Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Trump had in the past called him a puppet of the Koch brothers, said his record as governor has been a disaster. And yet these three guys are topping his list of potential running mates. None of them really seemed eager for that. What do you make of this talk?
I mean, look, Donald Trump never said, I never believe anything Donald Trump says, to be perfectly honest, except I think he does tell the truth when he says he believes in himself. I believe that's absolutely true. But I don't believe Trump when he made those comments in the past that were so derogatory towards his opponents. I don't think he actually really meant that. I think he said it because he thought it could help him win votes, or he thought it made him feel good. Now he's saying something entirely different, that maybe he wants him to be his vice president if he were so fortunate to win the nomination. I'm not sure I necessarily buy that either. I think what's going on is Trump realizes that he's close, that he can, in fact, become the nominee, and he's looking to pull any possible way, any votes that he can to get him over the hump. And by naming people who people might say, hey, these guys are actually qualified, and maybe Donald Trump isn't all that crazy, I think he's seeing that and sort of understands that he's trying to pull voters. But if he were to become the nominee, I really have no idea who he'd select. I've learned long ago that trying to figure out who the vice presidential nominees are going to be is a folly of a game.
We're talking right now with Harry Enten about Paul Ryan's denial that he would accept the Republican presidential nomination at a contested convention, where the delegate counts stand, and who might be the potential vice presidential picks on each side.
We'll get into the Democratic side of things, too, in just a bit. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Do you think Paul Ryan is right to say, no, don't pick me in a contested convention, pick somebody who's actually run on the Republican side? Do you have thoughts on the issue of a potential running mate for Trump or Cruz or Clinton or Sanders, for that matter? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@WPR.org. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation with Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, talking about the ongoing race for the White House.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Paul Ryan says, not it, not going to run, don't pick me. Do you think he's right to do that? What do you hope comes out of a potential Republican contested convention? Should it be whoever has the most votes, the most delegates going in? Should it be someone who's run, or should it be the best candidate as picked by the convention? How about the Democratic side? What are you thinking about the superdelegates? How do you hope they're going to swing in the race between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders? What are you watching for in New York? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@WPR.org.
And Harry, let's switch over to look at the Democrats now. We've got New York coming up in just about a week or so. Where do the Democratic campaign stand right now?
There hasn't been a single poll that has had Hillary Clinton up by anything less than 10 points. That's worse than she did 8 years ago against Barack Obama, but she's leading. And what we know right now is Hillary Clinton has, you know, an over 200 pledged delegate lead. And in order to really mount a comeback, Bernie Sanders overall, when we looked at it, needed to win in New York. And there's just not much of a sign that he's going to do that. He certainly closed in the polls from where they were earlier this year. But time has basically, it seems, unless something happens in the debate tomorrow night, it seems that time has basically run out. So I don't know what else to say, except that New York is a very diverse state, and Hillary Clinton does very well among black voters, which there are many of in New York, and she also does well with Jewish voters, which there are many of in New York, and right now she looks like she's poised to win, although, again, not by as large of a margin as she did 8 years ago.
And speaking of the superdelegates, we mentioned those a few moments ago. Senator Bernie Sanders picked up his first Wisconsin superdelegate last week. Here's State Assembly Representative David Bowen.
I want to make sure that their voices are heard, and currently there are no superdelegates supporting Senator Sanders, and I'm glad to be the first one.
And he had said that he's reflecting the will of Wisconsin voters. Do you think superdelegates, what's going to be the mix? How many of them are going to go with their candidate of choice? How many of them are going to follow their state or their district voters?
I think, you know, Hillary Clinton obviously has already racked up a very large superdelegate lead. It wouldn't be shocking if Bernie Sanders was able to pull a few of those who currently have voice support for Clinton and put him into his column. That happened 8 years ago with Barack Obama. He won over some of Clinton's supporters, but most, the overwhelming majority, stayed with her. And remember, the key difference from now and 8 years ago was Barack Obama had a lead in the pledged delegate count. Right now, it's actually Clinton who does. So, sure, it could be, you know, especially those who are on the sidelines, they may go with who their congressional district, their state voted for. But for the most part, I think those who are already with Clinton are going to stay with Clinton, and the superdelegate should help put her over the top.
It's interesting, just the last week, Harry, it seems as though both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have gotten a little short fused with each other and have accused each other of being unqualified for the job of president. How is that playing out in New York? How is it going over?
I mean, if you look, most of the people in New York who have the biggest voices are Hillary Clinton supporters, perhaps not surprisingly. So it hasn't gone over particularly well with them. But, you know, the polls are mostly stable. You know, again, they show somewhere between a 10 and a 20-point lead for Hillary Clinton. Most of them are more, maybe they say the 12 to 15-point range. But, you know, the campaign took a nasty turn. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But overall, the trajectory of the race seems to be staying the same.
Take a call now on the Democratic side of the ticket. We've got Mick calling from Eau Claire. Mick, hi.
Yes, hey, how you doing? Quick question related to the delegate count or the superdelegate count. Now, all this gets put forward before any votes really kind of go out. How is that really fair to a person trying to run and maybe be competitive to Hillary? And then what other impacts, and I'll take my answer off the phone, do you think that Rachel Joe Curran, the mayor, did on TV the other day? What do you think that's going to have? What impact? Thank you very much for letting me ask the question.
Mick, thanks for the call. So to sum up, if I have this story right, there was a skit, the New York Mayor de Blasio, Hillary Clinton, an actor from the Hamilton cast, a joke from the mayor about CP time. Stood for colored people time. Most people read that as seen as offensive. They joked about something politician time. That there's been a bit of outrage about that. Maybe that's something that'll upset people in New York. Harry, are you following that one?
Yeah, I sometimes I wonder what the heck politicians are thinking. That was offensive, I would say. A number of people found it to be offensive. Hillary Clinton's lucky that she basically was able to throw Mayor de Blasio under the bus. Which he did, saying it was his idea for the skit. We haven't had any real polling since then to get a real gauge. I'm not sure that it's the type of thing. If she had come up with the skit, maybe it would have been different. But clearly not a good moment for her, and certainly not a good moment for Bill de Blasio.
And Harry, is another bit of interesting media coverage from, I think it was just last night, actually, that Donald Trump had his family on CNN. What kind of effect does that sort of bringing in the family have, if any, on campaigns?
I think if, you know, you read what people's reaction were to at least Ivanka Trump, she makes Donald Trump look really good. She's a smart, intelligent woman. And if you associate her brand with Donald Trump's brand and you're a Republican voter, then I think it only does favors for him. And I think he obviously has a problem with women voters, although in Wisconsin he did about as well with women as he did with men. In many states, that's not the case. So kudos to him. I think it helped him out. Whether or not people really make their vote judgment based upon how, you know, smart the daughter or son of a politician is a whole other question. Certainly didn't hurt him, though.
Talking to Harry Enten from 538.com. But, Harry, part of that story may reinforce the idea that his campaign isn't that organized on getting ready to get delegates, to get votes. His kids didn't register in time, as I understand it, to vote in New York. Going along with that story in Colorado, where they didn't have names of their delegates available for people to vote for, or names of people who weren't their delegates, more signs of a lack of old-fashioned campaign organizing?
Yeah, so Ivanka Trump was a registered undeclared, and New York has a closed primary where only those who are registered with the party can vote, and the law is such that if you want to re-register with the other party, you have to do it very early. You had to do it in October of last year in New York State, and clearly that did not work out for Ivanka Trump and Eric Trump as well. Yeah, I think it does show a bit of disorganization. I think it's sort of that they forget the details. And it's perfectly fine to forget the details if you're running away with the race, but if you're only getting 37% of the vote and less than 50% of the pledged delegates, then it's not okay. Then you need to do better. And so far, in fact, he hasn't done better with the details. We'll see if he's able to pick that up going forward, because if he doesn't do better with the details, it could end up costing him the nomination.
We've got an email here from David in Madison who says, and I'm not sure about pronunciation here, but Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio would make an outstanding running mate for Hillary Clinton. He's a popular progressive senator from a critical swing state who would help shore up recalcitrant Bernie Sanders fans. Any sort of rumblings are you hearing about Senator Brown from Ohio, Harry?
Sherrod Brown would be, in my opinion, a great vice presidential pick for Hillary Clinton for the reasons that emailer said. He has progressive bona fides. There's no doubt about it. He has spoke to the ills of the working class. And the real question, though, is whether, A, he wants it, whether, B, Hillary Clinton has a good relationship with him, and then, C, which is something that's a little more insider baseball, if he were to resign his seat, the governor, John Kasich, who's a Republican, obviously, because he's running for the Republican nomination, would fill that void, and I'm not sure that Democrats would be willing to give up a Democratic seat, at least initially.
Harry, a lot of the story, a lot of the stuff we've talked about over the last bunch of months is who's going to drop out of the race when. It seems like four, maybe all five of the major party candidates are in this thing till the end. Do you see any change in that?
No, not really. I mean, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are certainly going on to June 7th and probably even a little bit afterwards when Washington, D.C. votes on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, Ted Cruz and Donald Trump aren't going anywhere. There's some question of whether John Kasich might, but, you know, the truth is he's only won one state so far and he seems to keep going, so why should we bet against his will to stay in the race?
Well, Harry, thanks a lot for joining us as always. Look forward to talking to you next week.
Sounds good.
That's Harry Enten. He's a senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. He joins us at This Week every time to talk about national politics, which, of course, these days, mostly the presidential race.
Coming up after the news, we look at a study that shows Wisconsinites are leaving rural areas for urban parts of the state. We'll talk about what that could mean coming up. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And by the way, coming up, we're also going to dial a Swede. Find out what that's all about coming up after the news. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll look at a significant shift in Wisconsin's demographics when it comes to urban and rural areas of the state.
First, the Swedish Tourist Association launched a new initiative this week to commemorate the 250th anniversary of the country's abolition of censorship.
The campaign is called Dial a Swede, and if you're willing to pay the international calling fee, you can get connected to a random Swede who'll talk to you about whatever.
Wisconsin has a decent-sized Swedish-American population. Plus, we were intrigued about what Swedes know about Wisconsin, so Veronica and I tried it out earlier today.
You will soon be connected to a random Swede somewhere in Sweden. This call may be recorded.
Hello?
Good dog. Jag heter Rob. Talar du engelska?
Norska.
Uh-oh.
No.
Do you speak English?
No, Norwegian. Yeah, English.
You do speak English?
Yeah, I speak English.
Excellent.
Oh,
perfect. This is Veronica, and I'm joined by Rob. He was trying to speak Swedish there. We're radio
that
hosts.
That sounded more like Norwegian.
Hey, I was close.
And what is your name?
My name is Victor.
Victor, and where do you live in Sweden?
I live in the capital. I live in Stockholm.
Oh, lovely.
Have you ever heard of Wisconsin? Do you know anything about Wisconsin?
I don't know that much about Wisconsin.
All right, well, yeah. We make a lot of cheese. Have you ever eaten Wisconsin cheese?
That's what exactly. I thought about cheese, but I wasn't sure. Maybe I would offend you.
No, you're dead
but
on.
We love cheese.
We love the cheese. We make a lot of cheese here. Is cheese a big thing in Sweden? What is your most famous product?
Well, you know, if we're going to talk cheese, there's a cheese called Hushållsost. It basically means like house cheese. Have you ever heard about surströmming?
No. What is that?
It's basically like a rotten fish that's fermented, and we eat that.
Is it good?
I don't think you guys would like it.
Probably not.
It's illegal in some countries.
It's
because
illegal.
It can be used as a biological weapon.
Oh, boy.
Because it smells so bad.
But wait, is that like the Norwegian lutefisk?
Okay, so we eat lutefisk in Sweden also, but lutefisk, it doesn't smell. It's more like a jello fish. Surströmming is basically rotten, but We're weird, but yeah.
But apart from trying this fish, if somebody from Wisconsin went to Stockholm, what's the one thing you would say they have to do while they're there?
Oh, hard question. Probably to Kungsträdgården in the summer when the Japanese flower trees are blooming. It's really cool, actually.
Are these the cherry blossom trees like we have in Washington, D.C.?
Exactly. Those are really, really, really beautiful.
And if you were to visit the United States, what's one thing you'd want to do, Wisconsin or anywhere in the country?
I would probably play football or something like that.
Soccer, what we call soccer or American football?
No, American football.
American football, okay.
I actually play it, so.
Really? So do you know the Green Bay Packers?
Yeah, that's my team.
That's your team?
So yeah.
That's great. Well, you really need to visit Wisconsin now.
Yeah. Clay Matthews is my favorite.
Oh, yeah. I look just like Clay Matthews, except I'm skinnier, way skinnier. I have long blonde hair, though, like him.
Hey, hold on, man. I'm going to grow a big beard like him.
Well, it's been fun talking to you. Good luck with your football career. I hope you can see the Packers play someday.
Yeah, hopefully.
Excellent. It's been fun. Victor, thank you so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was a random Swede named Victor from Stockholm. We talked to him as part of the Swedish Tourism Association's new Dial a Swede campaign. It runs through June 6th.
Now more than half of Wisconsin's counties saw a population loss over the past 5 years, according to recent U.S. Census estimates.
As a whole, the state's population grew by more than 80,000 people, but a lot of that growth happened in the state's counties that have metropolitan areas. Think Dane, Brown, Milwaukee counties, while most of the state's more rural counties saw populations go down.
So what's responsible for the growth of urban areas, and how does this affect the state overall?
David Egan Robertson joins us now. He's a demographer at the UW-Madison Applied Population Laboratory. David, thanks for joining us in the studio.
Well, thanks for having me on today, Rob. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, looking at these numbers, generally, what do they tell us about Wisconsin's population change and movement over the last half a decade?
Yeah. Just to sort of flesh out what this data set is, the Federal Census Bureau does annual population estimates for all the states, all the counties, all 3,142 counties in the country. And so they're looking at changes in births, deaths, and the migration patterns for these counties. And what we've been noticing, in particular with the Bureau's work this decade over the last 5 years, is that there's been a very strong slowdown in in total population change to begin with. If you look at the comparable period from in 2000 to 2005, the state grew about 3.5%. These last 5 years, it only grew about 1.5%. And that's well off from the U.S. level, where the whole population of the country grew about 4% over the last 5 years.
Now, if I understand my demography, when we're looking at that big number, that rate of change is determined by births, deaths, people moving in and people moving out. So where is that slowdown coming from?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing in that Wisconsin is facing what I call a demographic double squeeze right now. As you know, the difference between births and deaths is what we call natural increase. Back during the years prior to the start of the Great Recession, the state was averaging about 72,000 births per year. Once the recession hit, births started to drop, and for example, for the last 3 years, it's averaged only about 67,000. So that's a difference of like 5,000 births in each year. So as you look back to the when the recession started, we're talking about 25,000, fewer residents. In a sense, it's kind of hard to say they're missing births, but it just because of the recession, the birth rate dropped considerably. On the other hand, on the other side of the natural increase equation, number of deaths has been slowly rising.
As our population ages, presumably?
Population ages, right. For the first time in 2014, the number of total deaths in the state rose above 50,000 for the first time. And so the natural increase component is shrinking. And then as well, the migration component with the economic slowdown Wisconsin has, in terms of interstate migration, has been losing every year for about 6 or 7 years in a row. There is some international migration. We're not a big destination state for direct international migration, but that hasn't been enough to offset the loss to other states.
Now let's look at where these changes are happening. If I read it right, the census kind of broke this down into three categories: counties with a larger city, 50,000 or more, they call it metropolitan, cities or counties with a smaller city, say 10 to 50,000, and then ones without a city of that size. Where are we seeing growth among those? Where are we seeing declines?
Yeah, it is an interesting era in that nearly all of the population change, and this is true in Wisconsin, but also nationally, that nearly all the growth is happening in what we call our metropolitan counties. And so these are the ones with 50,000 or more people, and also adjoining counties where there's a lot of commuting ties. And this is true at the national level as well, that basically the country grows at about 2.5 million people per year. Mm-hmm. And over the last 5 years, all of the gain has basically accrued to metropolitan counties, not just in Wisconsin, but also nationwide.
As I think of the broad sweep of history, I think gradually we see humans moving more and more towards cities. Is this part of just a long gradual trend, or is this something that's really gone up and down?
Yeah, there's been, as you look back sort of to the historical record, and I went back and looked like through as far back as the 1950s. In the 50s, it's kind of an interesting phenomenon in Wisconsin of counties on the eastern and southeastern portion of the state gain population through migration, and then everything, you could almost draw a line sort of from Janesville to Madison and then diagonally up to about Manitowoc. All the counties to the northwest of that line basically lost population in the 50s. And then it's been variable over time. During the 1970s, there was a increase in rural population. There was, in the literature, it's described as sort of the rural renaissance. But then we were hit, particularly in the upper Midwest, by the Rust Belt recession, which started sort of in the late 70s into the early 80s. So again, rural areas started to decline. Cities held out okay. The 90s, there was good, solid growth in both metropolitan, non-metropolitan counties. And in the 2000s, it was decent everywhere. But again, once the recession hit, we did see, you know, we start looking at specific counties and really just looking at the year period of time of the recession and the years since the recession officially ended of that non-metropolitan population shrinking.
We're talking to demographer David Egan Robertson right now about why the population of Wisconsin's rural areas is shrinking while urban areas seem to be on the way up.
And you can join the conversation. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you recently moved from a rural area to an urban one, and why? Or have you gone against the grain and moved from a city to a more rural area in the state? If you've seen this trend firsthand, how has your community been affected? Call now at 800-642-1234 or leave us a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now we're picking up the conversation with demographer David Egan Robertson about why Wisconsin's rural population seems to be shrinking while the urban population is growing.
And we'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234 to put a face or at least a voice behind some of these trends. Have you moved from a rural area, a small town, to an urban area, a bigger city or a county near a city in the last few years? Why'd you make that change? Or if you've gone against the tide, why? Why did you move from a city to a smaller town, a rural area? What was behind that? And what do you think is behind the overall trend? Population, according to census data, going up in more urban areas, urban counties, down in rural counties in the state. Call 800-642-1234 or leave us a note on the Central Time Facebook page. We will go right to a caller. We've got Joe on the line in New Glarus. Joe, hi.
Hello.
What's your experience, Joe?
So my wife and I just moved pretty recently, actually, out to the country near New Glarus, Wisconsin. And I kind of just wanted to share what I thought might be one of the reasons less people are moving out to the country. When we were looking, a lot of the homes that we looked at were kind of older and more run down, and you start to get into more expensive fixes for some of them, and maybe a little bit more maintenance than a lot of the homes that you might find in the city. And also, we've noticed that a lot of our neighbors are much older than we are. We're in our 20s still, and almost all of our neighbors are older, even retired.
Interesting, Joe, and that's a really interesting point, David, this idea that rural counties may be older. First of all, you can tell us if that's true, and maybe that's a self-fulfilling prophecy if younger people don't want to move to a town because they perceive it as being mostly people much older than them.
Yeah, that is true. Median age in the non-metropolitan counties of the state is higher, particularly if you go up, you know, to the far north, to counties like Oneida and Vilas, Bayfield, Ashfield. The median age there is up around 50 or so. Statewide, it's around more like 38 or 39 at this point. It does become the case. This is true. You mentioned he lives in New Glarus, but St. Croix County is a classic example. It's basically a bedroom community for the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. And when the economy is really good there, housing costs are rising in the more immediate Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area. St. Croix is a big recipient of sort of new families moving in. You know, housing costs are lower there. People can get larger lots if they want in St. Croix County, and, you know, they can hop on I-94 and commute into the city in, you know, half an hour and work in the city, but live in St. Croix.
Oh, so that's interesting. So good economy drives up housing costs in what might be perceived as that desirable area, but that family, say, can't afford that, so that benefits the nearby counties in terms of the population growing up. Those people are looking outside of the direct metropolitan area for a place to commute from.
That's right. That's right. And I don't know if this particular caller works in the Madison area, but that may be the case. For those of us who live in Madison, just received our recent assessment and gulped a little bit at the increasing cost of our assessments here in Madison. I mean, that's all part of the effect. Those are sort of the anecdotal stories that underlie a lot of the evidence.
Joe, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. We'll go next to Dennis in Wautoma. Dennis, hi.
Hi there. How are you doing this afternoon?
Good. What's your story, Dennis?
Well, my partner and I, his family had had property in Washara County for the last 45 years, and we built a place near their property on Pine Lake about 15 years ago, and made the decision to do our own retirement up here, took early retirement and came up here a little over two and a half years ago. And, I mean, both of us had very, very significant jobs down in the Chicago area, which made it possible for us to invest and buy property up here and to live in in the way we were accustomed to, very comfortably. But as I look around and I see what's going on, because I volunteer with a couple of food pantries and do other volunteer work here. What I see here, and we also have rental property, so that reinforces this, is the fact that there just aren't any really what I would call good living wage jobs in the Washara County area, certainly in the Wautoma area, for people to really, you know, to start a family, buy a home, and stay here. So what we see as people grow up and you know, their kids are growing up, they're all heading for Oshkosh, for Appleton, Madison, where have you, places that have some industry and some really decent paying jobs.
Dennis, thank you so much. A lot there. So the idea that there may be these places where people see them as desirable. They like the small town or having some nature nearby, but there's no jobs there. So maybe the best they can aspire to is to retire to a place like that after not having worked there.
Yeah. And that is certainly part of the big story with this, you know, metro, non-metro or urban-rural bifurcation that's happening with population movement right now. For example, over the last 3 years, about 2012 to 2015, metro counties in Wisconsin gained about 4% in terms of total number of jobs. But those non-metro rural counties basically stayed flat, as about 0.5%. Again, in times where the economy is not as strong, the areas that feel it the hardest are the rural areas, and you can even see sort of on a scale as you get further and further away from, you know, the large cities of 50,000 or more, and even places where you get away from cities that, or villages that have like 10,000. You can just see this pattern where employment change is just, in a lot of cases, going negative the more remote you get from any sort of large settled area.
Dennis, thanks for that call. We're talking to demographer David Egan Robertson from UW-Madison about populations going up in more urban counties in the state, down in rural counties. Our next caller, Nikki in East Troy. Nikki, hi.
Hi. I was calling to touch subject on that also, because I did the complete opposite. I went from living in Chicago as a little girl. We moved to Milwaukee. And from Milwaukee, I decided to move into a smaller town at East Troy. For me, you know, the city just got really cramped. It's the violence. And for me, thinking about my family, you know, I didn't want to grow up around that. I didn't want my family growing up around it. So I decided to take a move and move to a smaller, quieter town just for more protection, to feel also like a safe haven. You also get the beauty of the nature, and, you know, you see the sunrise, sunset, you see all the animals so much clearer. You don't have to worry about dealing with as many people as well.
Nikki, thanks a lot for that call. Not too much time left. David, both of those counties she's moved from and to would be in that metropolitan county list that we were talking about. But do we see still this move from urban to that suburban county belt, especially when we're looking at a place like Milwaukee and its neighboring counties?
There is still some movement, not sort of the brisk movement it's been in past decades, and in particular in areas where there are smaller metro areas, for example, Madison, Green Bay, La Crosse, Eau Claire. We do see population growth sort of in these what we call the small metro core counties, but any outlying counties are staying level or even losing a little bit of population.
And David, as we start to wrap up, have we seen all the shakeout from the Great Recession?
Well, yeah, it's still kind of sort of remaining to be seen. A big concern for people who do demography work like I do is what is going to happen with the birth rates in particular. As I mentioned earlier, normally they recover after recession. Here we seem to sort of reach a period where is this sort of a new normal? Where people of that cohort who are now coming into their sort of reproductive ages, are they actually going to be having smaller families than we predicted even 5 or 10 years ago?
And you're going to be watching for the next actual full-on census. Just briefly, what's the big news you're going to watch for there?
Yeah, that'll be in 2020. Again, an interesting thing will be how is Wisconsin grown across an entire 10-year period. Also to look comparatively at, our adjacent states like Minnesota, which is about 400,000 people behind us right now, but is actually growing a little bit faster than Wisconsin. So it'll be interesting to see after 2020 how close, particularly like Minnesota and Wisconsin, are in population size.
We'll leave it there, David. Thanks so much for joining us today.
You're quite welcome.
That was demographer David Egan Robertson from UW-Madison. We've been talking about population changes here in Wisconsin. Overall population going up according to new census data, but mostly this is urban counties, counties with a city bigger than 50,000. Population's going down in rural counties. You could still share your story if you've moved from one to the other. Just head over to the Central Time Facebook page and tell us which way you went.
Yeah, Noir here, yeah.
Hey, Noir, it's Danny.
Hey, long time no hear there.
Yeah, you still in the tiptoe business?
Oh, yeah, maybe. Depends on the, you know, the Mazuma there.
The Mazuma, right. Lots of Mazuma guy. And the jobs in Mega Macintosh, the huge Honeycrisp, the fat Fuji.
You mean the Big Apple,
yeah.
That's what you're talking about, huh?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
That's Garrison Keillor as Private Eye Guy Noir from a recent episode of A Prairie Home Companion. And word on the street is he'll be hanging up the microphone soon, and there's a plan for a new incarnation of the long-running show.
Keillor has talked about retirement on and off for years. He is in the midst of his farewell tour now for the show, with a final broadcast scheduled for July 1st at the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles, a very un-Lake Wobegon-esque place to end it for him.
Right, but the new news is what happens next? Sounds like a new look for the show and also a new host.
Chris Thiele will take over as host starting this October. That was just announced, the October part. He's been a frequent musical guest on the show. He's known for his part in the bands Punch Brothers and Nickel Creek.
And with the musician leaving the show, Keillor and Thiele say it's going to focus more on the musical side. As Keillor says, it will be a music show with comedy add-ons. So it's gonna be a different show.
Maybe no more Guy Noir there, we can do our own fake Private Eye show.
What could go wrong with that?
Nothing at all. We'll go out with the Punch Brothers. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.